standing by. I would like to remind all parties today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect. I will now turn the call over to your host, Mr. Robert Beyer-Offit. Sir, you may begin.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Rod, turn it over to you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Bob. I actually won't be giving the presentation. My colleague, Luke Cruff, who is the chief engineer on this project, will give it. But I just want to give a quick overview of the project. This is a collaborative research project that Ricardo have been engaged on for about 2.5 years. And it's the original idea of the project. We came up with the idea of the project because of late 2007, there was a lot of interest in having diesel engines in light-duty passenger cars, a lot of programs being developed. And we were looking, what could a spark-ignited engine developed as a competition for a diesel engine in those applications? As it was, with the fuel prices increasing, at, you know, 6 months later, those diesel programs had gone by the wayside, but you know, we carried on with this research project, and it really is an extreme boosted spark-ignited engine, which we think is applicable for many areas of transportation. So it's a project we've been engaged on. We hope to have demonstrator vehicles driving around later in this year with this engine in. So that's where we are. So I'd like to introduce Luke Cruff, who is the chief engineer on the project, and he'll go through the presentation.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and get started. Slide one is really just a cover slide, so I'm going to just go ahead and move to slide two. Slide two is really, this is just kind of an overview of the project. What are we trying to do? The name of the project is Ethanol Boosted Direct Injection, but you'll see as I go through this presentation that this is really an engine technology that's looking at fully flexible fuel options, so from E0 or straight gasoline through to E85. The idea being to optimize the calibration and hardware for any blend in between those two fuels with minimum compromises. So overall, what we're doing is in the upper right-hand kind of quadrant of this slide, you can see we're putting a 3.2-liter spark-ignited engine in place of into a 3,500 or one-ton pickup truck, which is replacing either a 6-liter naturally aspirated gasoline engine or a 6.6-liter diesel engine. Our particular hardware is going into a General Motors pickup. General Motors is not specifically involved with this project. We've purchased the pickup trucks outside of their involvement from a standard dealer. So the overall objective of this engine really is to produce a high enough torque output to be able to replace this engine, realistically replace it in the vehicle, including trailer tow capabilities, etc., to allow a large amount of downsizing and improve fuel economy. So you can see the two charts on the bottom of the slide here. On the left-hand side, the FTP75 highway fuel economy test in US06 results. These are vehicle simulation results for the current technology gasoline, the current technology diesel, the EBDI engine running on gasoline, and then the EBDI engine running on E85. And these are volumetric consumption or miles per gallon. I'll get more specific about the fuel economy gains and on which cycles a little bit later in the presentation, but of course that's one of our main objectives for doing this downsizing. But to allow that downsizing to happen, of course you need to make very high torque output, which in this case translates to very high BMEP output as well. We'll review the BMEP levels here in a couple of slides. But just a couple, just an example here on the bottom right-hand corner, you can see the replacement diesel torque curve in the black dotted line, the replacement gasoline torque curve in the gray line toward the bottom of the plot, and our target torque curve on E85 for the EBDI engine. One other thing that's probably worth pointing out is this is a highly collaborative project. It is a research project for Ricardo. It involves a lot of other industry players as well who have brought various levels of engineering and parts to the project. You can see Growth Energy there representing the ethanol community. Bayer is involved on the cooling system, so charge air coolers and EGR coolers. Bosch is handling the fuel system, the entire West system, so pumps, rails, and injectors. Adelphi's working with us in a couple areas, but the primary one that we've tested so far is the ignition system, so we got some advanced ignition components from them. Federal Mogul handling a lot of base engine components, pistons, rods, head gaskets, those kind of things. Granger and Worrell doing castings for us out of the UK, and then Honeywell is our turbocharging partner. So this is, again, it's a research program for everybody. We're all just trying to put our best foot forward in the various technology areas that each of these companies represent, and really just to maximize the learning process. So, moving over to slide three, Rod talked a little bit about internally what some of our drivers were, and obviously, the competition or evaluation of diesel versus gasoline or ethanol powertrains is an ongoing thing, but certainly specifically some of the key drivers for us are CAFE regulation, which obviously everybody on this call is probably very familiar with these days. And you can see they're moving toward 2016 with the 35.5 MPG combined requirement. Looking forward, not only at current emission standards on the upper right-hand corner, but the upcoming LEV 3 proposal as well, which you can see in the green, represented in the green bars on the emissions chart. And then, of course, the RFS 2 renewable fuel volume requirements, which are being mandated as well. So all these things being put together forced us to look in the direction of how much can we get out of a spark-ignited engine reliably with high efficiency and still enabling us to make the required criteria emissions level. Moving on to slide four then, what we concepted for this project was a highly modified 3.2-liter V6 engine. We modified the engine. It's probably easier to tell you what we didn't modify than what we did. I think we might have left a couple components alone, but basically everything was at least somewhat modified, if not heavily modified, to obtain a level of 180 bar maximum cylinder pressure, which allowed us to not only make high torque when using ethanol, but make that torque at high thermal efficiency as well to place the combustion event where it needs to be against the slider crank mechanism for highest thermal efficiency. Basic architecture of the engine, it is a dual overhead cam, variable valve timing engine. It's got, as most production engines are today in this size class. Initially, we architected a parallel sequential turbo system, which was wastegate controlled, basically based on the available hardware that that we had at the time. Really, the initial testing that I'm going to report on here today and show you some results on was really combustion system development testing, engine robustness, etc. We've since worked fairly extensively on the turbo system match, and we have a new match that'll be in the vehicles. But and then the final kind of big technology enabler on this engine was long route or low pressure EGR system, which you can see in the schematic on the upper right hand corner there. After the number one and number two turbos, we scavenge exhaust gas, place it back through a cooler and a valve into the incoming airstream into the compressor. So low pressure EGR was chosen because where this technology really helps on a spark-ignited engine is in the mitigation of the tendency to knock, which is worse at high loads and low engine speeds. A short route EGR, high pressure EGR system, does not provide the adequate EGR flow in those conditions. And so a lot of diesel engines do run short route EGR, but for this application, we chose long route EGR. You can see a couple of the, just a couple of pictures here on the bottom left-hand corner, the crankshaft system, and that's a combustion bowl, and of course, what you can't see is the matching fuel injector spray geometry that goes along with that. That's a combustion system that we've been working on developing for quite a while now on other projects, and it's carried over into this project. And then you can see on the right-hand side and the lower picture there, Our initial concept, which had the charge air coolers kind of hanging out over the valve covers with a central single throttle and small volume intake manifold, which is kind of showing the purple color there. We have since integrated that function together into an integrated charge air cooler intake manifold, and I'll show up a picture of that concept a little bit later. Moving on now to slide 5. Some general targets and specifications that we had.
So, Luke, is that the efficiency? Which slide is that? Slide 5, is the title efficiency maps?
No, it is EBDI targets and specifications.
Gotcha.
Everybody have that one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so targets and specifications, just at a high level here. Again, sweat volume about 3.2 liters. The engine does have integrated exhaust manifolds, which has been an interesting mechanical challenge. Basically, integrated exhaust manifolds are spectacular for reduction in part count, for durability improvement in terms of reduction in manifold cracking, etc. However, when you're running an engine with EGR recirculation, which tends to cool the combustion down, and or you're running ethanol, which also tends to cool the combustion down, the cooled integrated exhaust manifold isn't necessarily what you want to put the turbo in its happiest place. In other words, it robs some energy from the turbo and puts it back into the coolant system. So that was the base engine hardware that we have, but we have learned that that is something that's potentially compromising the thermal efficiency on the engine somewhat, around 1% or so. Of course, that said, in terms of packaging and simplicity of packaging the whole system into the vehicle, the integrated exhaust manifold works very, very, very well for that. Moving down to power, really this project is not about horsepower, it's about torque. But of course, when you're making high torque, like a diesel, you don't need a lot of engine speed to make a lot of horsepower. So we've limited the peak engine speed to 5,000 RPM. The torque or the BMEP curves on the right show out to 6,000 RPM, but that's we've limited all the hardware to 5,000 RPM. And the targets there are 400 plus horsepower on 98 round gasoline and right around 450 on E85. You can see, I guess we'll just talk through the BMEP plots here. On the right-hand side, the existing gasoline engine running somewhere around 12 bar BMEP at its peak torque point, somewhere around 4,300 to 4,400 RPM. The diesel engine running about 18 bar BMEP at its peak torque, which happens at 1,600 RPM. And then, of course, you can see the BMEP curves for the gasoline and E85. These are the target curves that we established for the program. We have somewhat overachieved on a low-end torque on this engine. We're slightly above our torque goals at 1,500 through about 2,500 RPM. Higher speeds than that, we haven't been able to accomplish this torque curve based on the turbo match, but that should be fixed with this next round of hardware. But the focus of our investigation has been on high high low speed torque, I guess is how I put that. And we've been able to achieve very, very good numbers there. So you can see here there's a huge difference in the BMEP levels of these engines. And of course that makes calibrating these engines, this type of an engine application, challenging. As you're on cycle, even on the FTP 75 cycle, which is a relatively light load, you are well into the boosted region of the engine in some cases on that cycle. And of course in the US06 you're far into the boosted region of the engine. So in terms of handling the turbo system and how you calibrate for that, it's pretty interesting. And we'll talk about that a little later. I've got a usage plot plotted over the BSFC maps coming up later. In terms of transient torque response time, obviously that's another huge issue for us. With putting a very small downsized engine in any application requires the transient torque response time to be very good for vehicle drivability. You can see there what our our targets are in terms of time to steady state torque percentage. And then on fuel system, this is another big enabler, both for ethanol and for enhanced gasoline mixture preparation. Going to the 20 MPA, which is 200 bar cylinder pressure with a twin pump DI system, that Bosch has provided. This has enabled us to do some things in terms of flow rate on the injectors that may not be possible with a 15 or 16 MPA fuel system.
How common is the fuel system you use?
Got a question from the audience?
Go ahead.
How common is the fuel system that you used with the twin pump?
Using twin pump isn't very common at all, but the pump itself is becoming more and more common in the U.S. on direct injection.
Yeah, this is basically a production pump. We're running two pumps because of the flow rate requirement, as opposed to trying to push one pump very, very hard. So we're trying to stay within the design tolerances of the pump. These pumps are driven off the exhaust cam with a lobe at the rear of the exhaust cam, which is fairly common practice in most of the DI applications you see out there today. All right, moving, talking about a little bit of the internal engine hardware, moving over to slide six. You can see here I've got a picture of a piston and a connecting rod, and obviously, given the gasoline engine package that we had to deal with, this is an aluminum block, aluminum head engine with four bolts per cylinder. So obviously we're somewhat limited on the head bolt torque and loading, clamp loading we can get on the head gasket, so that's a big challenge. The other challenge, of course, is to withstand this type of cylinder pressure in a gasoline piston package with relatively minimal crown height. So if you take a look at this piston, you can see we've significantly enlarged the wrist pin diameter to enable us to hit these levels of torque, and we've put an iron ring carrier in the top ring groove of the piston, which is basically a carryover technology from diesel applications, and of course the connecting rod is much more robust than you might find in an engine of this displacement that's a lower output level. Of course, with those changes come the compromises of reduction of maximum engine speed, but because of the high levels of torque output on this engine, basically that equation works out fairly well. There's no need to really run over 5,000 RPM. That allows us to make the cylinders, the reciprocating system, very robust, be able to handle the high cylinder pressures without any issue at all, and still keep the inertial loads in check on the crank and rod system. You can see on the lower left-hand side, we did integrate the main bearing caps with the ladder frame. This is probably maybe one of the least production viable solutions in the engine. Certainly could be made much more production viable with another design iteration, but basically this was a something that we put on the engine just to make sure the bottom end would stay together, as that wasn't really the focus of the development program, so we wanted to make sure it was robust. And you can see a cutaway of the engine there on the bottom right-hand side with that ladder frame replacing the place where the baffle usually sits over the oil pan for windage. And you can also see a section cut there through the charge air coolers and intake manifold, basically just an open intake manifold. And then, of course, upper right-hand corner, there's the engine on test. We basically took our piping system concept and expanded it as much as we could to try to get as many temperature, pressure, and flow probes into the system as we possibly could without compromising the airflow performance. So in order to be able to gather heat distribution data, et cetera. So obviously our in-vehicle system doesn't look anything like this, but this is the hardware level that I'll be reporting the data on today. Moving on then to slide seven, EBDI efficiency maps. So basically what we've got here is four plots. The top two are E0 or gasoline with and without EGR recirculation. The bottom two are E85 with and without EGR recirculation. So this is not the full performance curve in the map. This is the region that we've achieved lambda 1 air-to-fuel ratio on. So you can see that as the speed goes up, and our current boosting system was not able to push as much EGR as we would have desired. Therefore, we had to start to enrich at the top end to keep temperatures in check. And obviously, that's something that we're trying to address as we go forward. But again, this is not the peak. This is not the peak load points, but just the lambda one, or stoichiometric operating maps. So you can see from the plots that I don't know if you can really see this detail, but kind of the heart of the efficiency is right around 2,000 RPM and 12 or 13 bar BMEP, and you could, which is 1,000 or which is about 12 or 1,300 kPa, which is the unit that's on the y-axis here. And you can see that we're hitting about 230 grams per kilowatt hour on gasoline with EGR recirculation employed, about 239 without. So that's not really a huge difference, although it's certainly appreciable. However, the real key here for the EGR recirculation system is the broadening of the high efficiency area. So the under 240 grams per kilowatt hour efficiency area you can see in the blue there in the upper left hand plot is much, much wider on gasoline with EGR recirculation employed than without. And again, our objective is to continue to expand that region as we continue to enhance the combustion and boosting systems to allow us to introduce more EGR to the combustion process. On the E85 front, which is the lower two plots, there is a slight difference, a slight improvement from running. I'm sorry, was there a question? Okay, from running the EGR, but it's a much lower value in terms of improvement than the gasoline engine. So you know, on the order of about 1% for ethanol, and that's to be expected. As ethanol really, with its high octane and high heat of vaporization characteristics, doesn't suffer from spark knock nearly as much as, or really at all compared to gasoline. And so you wouldn't expect nearly the efficiency gain that you get on gasoline when you introduce EGR to the combustion process. The slight improvement we did get is basically traceable back to the pumping loop of the engine. The turbochargers are running in a slightly more advantageous position when we're running EGR in some cases, which is where the efficiency really came from. So it's not really an efficiency benefit based on the combustion process. Moving on to slide 8 then, I took just one example point from the gasoline curves. This is at 2,000 RPM, slightly higher load, up around 1600 kPa or 16 bar BMEP, so slightly above the peak efficiency point. And you can see there that the engine running with 0% EGR, running about 244 grams per kilowatt hour in terms of BSFC, and with the EGR recirculation is just over 236. The upper right-hand plot shows the difference in CA 50 points, so basically that's pointing out the difference in location of the combustion process. So without the EGR, because of knock limitation, we weren't able to advance the combustion peak pressure point as much as we would have liked. That resulted in a CA 50 measurement of 17.1 degrees after top dead center. We improved that by about 3.5 degrees with the addition of the 15.5% EGR. The difference in ignition timing there, you can see about 9 degrees. So, and obviously the difference between 9 and the 3.5 degree improvement is the reduction in burn rates. In other words, when we're putting 15.5% EGR into the combustion process, the overall burn rates slow down. Peak pressure, as you would expect on the bottom left-hand plot, is slightly higher, again, based on a slightly more advantageous peak pressure position. But you can see at this running condition, 76 bar peak pressure is obviously less than half of the peak pressure capability of the engine. So this is kind of right in the middle of where the engine would run, a point that's very important for drive cycles and potentially light towing. And of course, we've published some other data up in the 3,000 to 3,500 RPM range where you might be for a heavier towing type point with similar types of advantages from running the EGR recirculation. Just to be clear, I have a comment at the bottom of this page. This data was taken at equivalent knock intensity, so we're not running one system more on the edge than another system, and it's run at equivalent air-fuel ratio. So all the benefit here is coming from the combustion process timing. I mentioned very high low-speed torque earlier, so moving on to slide 9 then. Obviously, that is a requirement of our engine, and I didn't show a high load, a full load curve yet, but I just wanted to highlight some of our performance of the engine at very low engine speeds, around 1600 RPM. So this is actually at the peak torque speed of the replaced diesel engine. So what this plot shows is the black bars, the thick bars read on the left-hand y-axis in terms of BMEP, and the line plot here with the boxes reads on the right-hand side, which is in-cylinder peak pressure. So just moving from left to right across this slide, the V8 diesel is running at about 18 bar BMEP, which is the number I highlighted before. And to do that, it's using about 145 bar of peak cylinder pressure. Now, there are certainly diesels out there running much higher cylinder pressure than that, but that's this particular engine example. The V6 running on E85 at 1600 RPM is producing 30 bar BMEP, so it's a very, very high torque output, obviously, and it's using about 155 bar peak cylinder pressure there to accomplish that 30 bar BMEP. And then the gasoline engine is making 26 bar BMEP, but of course, based on its later combustion, it's not nearly as thermally efficient as the ethanol or diesel engine. And of course, it uses a lot less cylinder pressure, about 95 bar peak cylinder pressure, which for a gasoline engine at this engine speed is still relatively high. But basically, the point of this slide is, as you look at heavy downsizing, we wanted to try to understand what the base engine implications were. You know, did we need to go to an iron block? Are we going to hit extremely high and ridiculous cylinder pressures that we don't really know how to deal with in the powertrain world? And the answer is no. The answer is because of the difference between the auto and the diesel combustion cycles, basically, while the diesel combustion cycle, because of the compression ratio, gives you slightly higher thermal efficiency, you get more crankshaft torque output for relatively less cylinder pressure with a spark-ignited combustion process. So that allows you to run smaller engines at higher crankshaft load factors or BMEP without ridiculously high cylinder pressures that we don't know how to deal with. So and that's very interesting when you go to apply spark-ignited engine technology in things other than pass car, which in terms of off-road equipment or medium-duty truck equipment. And that's not really the focus of this this particular phone call, but it's an interesting discussion that can be taken offline if anybody's interested. Moving on to slide 10 then, where does all this data get us? This slide's a little busy. These are the vehicle simulation results we've got on the engine so far. So let me just kind of walk you through it from left to right. On the left, stacked up there, you can see the operational curves of the naturally aspirated gasoline engine, the diesel engine, and the 3.2-liter EBDI engine over the current regulated cycle. So USO6 cycle is in green. Each one of those dots represents 1 second operation. The FTP 75 plot is in blue, which is mostly covered up by the orange highway fuel economy test speed and torque plot. So as expected, the naturally aspirated gasoline engine kind of looks like it's got a flat top to its torque curve, and if you've seen the torque curve, it does have. And so, of course, it has to shift the transmission to achieve some of the hills and things on these regulated cycles. So it uses about 4,100 engine RPM and pretty much up to its peak torque of around 500 Newton meters. The diesel engine, and if you've driven one, you understand that it works completely differently, uses about 2,700 peak engine RPM and uses pretty much its peak torque capability of 900 Newton meters on a couple of points, but a significantly higher torque load than the gasoline engine does on these particular cycles. Then on the bottom plot is our 3.2 liter EBDI engine with its higher torque capability, but still running up against the gasoline transmission. So this is before we optimized shift points and gear ratios. And this is how the truck will initially be built before some further development on the transmission side of things. But you can see here, utilizing quite a bit less engine speed, only about 3,100 or 3,200 RPM as opposed to 4,100 RPM on the gasoline engine, and using up to right around 650 Newton meters of torque at the highest load demand point. Just in the center of the plot, for reference, is the highway fuel economy test on the top, the US06 there in the center, and then the FTP 75 on the bottom. And the red lines represent the various phases of the FTP test, the three bag phases. So you can see then, taking those same operational points from the bottom left, going up to the upper right hand portion of the slide here, applying those across our BSFC map, which I showed earlier, you can see how the engine, in most cases, is running at a much higher efficiency point than it would be without the EGR. And, of course, you can also see that some gear ratio changes and a slight downspeeding of the engine would be advantageous and would still be well within the stoichiometric region of the engine. So there's some shift point optimization and transmission gear ratio optimization that can still be done on this particular data. But from what we've run so far, this is an 8,000 pound pickup truck, again with the standard transmission ratios assumed. You can see then in the FTP 75, I've got fuel economy gains or improvements here. On the FTP 75, now this is referencing the baseline gasoline versus EBDI on gasoline, okay? So on the FTP 75, that's 27%. You can see in our simulation that we're right around parity or just above the diesel engine on the city cycle, just behind the diesel engine, or maybe 10% behind the diesel engine in terms of miles per gallon on the highway cycle, and about the same percentage behind on the US06. So again, you can see the requirement to really understand the drive cycle, and as you can see the difference in the three drive cycles here and the difference in system reaction between which engine works best where. The ethanol engine works best really on the US06 cycle, and that's somewhat to be expected. That's the most highly loaded cycle, and that's where the ethanol shows the biggest benefit versus its heating value loss against gasoline per gallon. So we can talk a little bit more about that here later if you want to. Highway fuel economy test, again, gasoline to gasoline, 16% improvement. The combined fuel economy improvement I'm showing here is not a five cycle average. We don't have any cold test data on this engine yet. So this is a 55-45 split between the city and highway number, which is kind of the old way to calculate combined fuel economy.
Question. Yeah. In the chart you're showing, the E85 fuel economy is gallons liquid. No, it doesn't correct for the lower heating value.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Is there a second question on that or no? Okay. Yeah, and all I'm pointing out in the US06 is if you calculate the percent difference between the gasoline and ethanol there, it is quite a bit less than the actual heating value difference of the two fuels, and that's because of the thermal efficiency benefit that you get at the higher loads with ethanol. So again, that's not nearly the gasoline is much better here than a gasoline engine would be if it was running without the EGR recirculation system. So based on those results and the dyno testing that we did, we've now been working on an updated design.
One more question for the audience here.
Yep,
I just want to reconfirm that you said that in your test, your E85 was 10% less efficient in miles per gallon?
No. This is, no, it's more than that in terms of miles per gallon.
Okay, well... Okay, because at some point you threw out the number 10% less efficient in miles per gallon. What was 10% less efficient?
I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure what I was referencing there. Oh, yeah, sorry, that's the difference between, if you look in the highway fuel economy test, that's the rough difference between the diesel and the EBDI gasoline number on the highway fuel economy test.
Okay, and what was the overall... loss in efficiency, just because I'm curious.
Loss in efficiency between what and what?
Say between either E85 to gasoline or E85 to diesel baseline.
Well, I don't have all the percentages here in front of me, but you can pretty much see from the charts that the E85 on the FTP 75 and highway fuel economy test are roughly, the percent difference in miles per gallon is roughly the same difference as the percent difference in heating value, which you would expect at the lighter loaded cases. The only time that we're bridging the gap significantly in terms of improving on the heating value of the ethanol is in the US06 chart. And that's a comparison between the dark blue and the darker gray columns. I'm not sure if that was what your question was driving at.
Thank you.
Sure. So in terms of design update, moving over to slide 11 now, we have, like I said, integrated the charge air coolers into the intake manifold, and you can see that in the schematic drawing on the right-hand side with the dual throttles. This does not represent the absolute latest and greatest system for either boosting system or after treatment. Obviously, that's confidential information, but those vehicles will be out running around later this calendar year. And you can see a design interpretation of our current system there on the left. We do have plans now to use variable geometry turbochargers. And obviously, I can't speak specifically about those until the project is released, but the boosting system is significantly different from the initial boosting system that we ran the testing on. And the package, as you can see there, has become much more concise and is now available to fit inside the vehicle package, and we're actually building mock-up vehicles at the moment. And we'll be back on the dyno for further testing on this project in June. So that's the end of the slides that we had prepared for today, and hopefully that's enough information to spark some questions. So I guess we'll turn it back over to you and lead us through the rest of it.
Yes, thank you very much, Luke. He's right. This is the time when we can turn it over for general questions. So please.
I've got a question from DOT. In terms of emissions, how does the modified engine compare with an unmodified diesel engine?
By unmodified diesel, what do you mean?
Same engine with all changes.
The same engine with all these changes made. is it?
Without the changes.
Oh, without the changes made, sorry.
Right. So some of the, so basically the stock diesel against this engine in terms of emission.
Right.
Yeah. This engine will be quite a bit cleaner. So the aftertreatment system on this engine is simply a three-way catalytic converter. The objective being to run the engine at the stoichiometric air-fuel ratio all the time. So the three-way catalytic converter will give us the same type of conversion efficiencies that we get today. So the biggest emissions challenge on this particular engine is, or on any turbocharged engine, is that the turbochargers tend to act as a heat sink in front of the catalytic converter for the first 20 to 30 seconds of operation. And so SULEV emissions requirements are not what we're shooting for right off the bat, but that's our end goal in terms of emissions compliance on this. Does that answer your question?
Yep. I wonder if you would, could give us some thought on possible weight penalties for running the engine at a higher compression ratio.
In terms of base engine weight?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In terms of base engine weight?
Yeah, general weight.
Yeah. Basically, the weight penalty from this particular engine package comes from the turbos, the extra coolers, and the extra radiator capacity that you need. That, of course, is not dissimilar to a diesel system. In fact, the breathing system on this engine and a current diesel engine look a lot alike. We have been able to stay with an aluminum block so far in the development, and that is how we plan to put the engines into the vehicle. Obviously, in volume production, that decision would be left up to the OEM. But we don't see any reason that advanced aluminum block can't support the needs of this engine. So, in terms of weight penalty, we don't see it on the base engine. We certainly don't see a huge weight penalty, and we don't see the need right now to go to an iron block. Again, that's pretty application specific. But for pass car, speaking about pass car and light duty truck, we think that's the case.
Do you have any thoughts on engine durability? The higher compression ratios, higher pressures.
Yeah, in terms of durability development, this is basically a diesel engine now. So like I said, the top ring of the piston is protected by a steel carrier. Again, that helps reduce the deformation of the piston under pressure loads. The entire bearing and reciprocating system of the engine has to be designed for that. But basically, that's just engine development. There's really no bigger challenge on this specification of an engine than there is on a diesel engine. So really, it's a matter of cost, slightly increased cost on your bearing materials, slightly better crankshaft and rod materials, potentially, like I said, a steel liner on the piston, those kind of things, which are small incremental changes, but obviously they need to be considered.
How much do you think your new design will improve mileage, MPG?
I don't think it'll be significant. I think we've gained most of the mileage gain, and because we've been able to map the part of the engine map that drives the regulated cycles, I think where the new turbo system is really going to help us is in towing capacity, towing performance, and fuel economy during towing. So the objective there is, again, to be able to run stoichiometric under heavy towing loads, to be able to push high levels of EGR through the combustion process, which aids in efficiency. So we're trying to move that high efficiency point up in the speed range and up in the load range as much as possible to allow further downsizing.
I thought on your website you mentioned that there were fairly significant efficiency gains when using E15 or E10. Is that correct?
I don't think E15 or E10. We believe there's some intermediate blends that obviously aren't publicly available at the moment, but could be quite advantageous to run in this type of an engine. So, you know, intermediate blends being like an E40 or an E50 type blend.
Is engine performance, is ethanol share in the fuel sort of a proxy for research octane number?
Somewhat, yeah. It appears, though, that you can have quite a bit less ethanol than 85% and still have a very high research octane number. And the interesting thing is potentially an improved motor octane number as well. So,
the refiners basically make E15 by further reducing the aromatic share in the gasoline and holding octane constant.
There won't be a consumer benefit if that's how they choose to do it, right? That's the profitable direction for the oil company, but it's not the mileage direction for the consumer, of course.
With this engine?
With any engine, yeah. I mean, this engine, I don't consider E10 or E15 to really be a talking point only because, for this type of engine technology, only because, as you just mentioned, those blends still hit the 87, 89, and 92 pump octane numbers that we have today. So there's not going to be a significant benefit for the ethanol there. Basically, the ethanol is allowing you to blend subpar gasoline blending constituents and still make 87 or 89 or whatever your goal is.
So as a takeaway from this, and I apologize for my ignorance here, but that you're able to get close to the same miles per gallon as gasoline with E85, which is what we're not seeing with E85 use now. Is that correct?
No, we're not hitting the same mileage in miles per gallon with E85 and E0. We've cut into the gap somewhat that you get in current vehicles, because obviously in current vehicles you get 28 or 25% worse fuel economy in miles per gallon when you run E85 versus gasoline. We've been able to cut that, somewhat. Obviously, you're not going to be able to fully make up the difference in heating value between those two fuels. But with this technology package, you do cut into that gap somewhat. But I want to be clear that we're not getting the same fuel economy on E85 as we are on E0.
Do you have any thoughts on the interaction between engine complexity and manufacturing cost and reliability? And before you answer, I should point out that I own a vehicle with a Bosch turbocharger.
Mercedes.
yeah, we have a lot of thoughts about that. Actually, I mean we have an entire roadmap, obviously, here at Ricardo, and a lot of other companies have those as well. But there is increasing cost for increasing mileage benefit. It's just a matter of what's the biggest bang for the buck. So these days, as an OEM, you're willing to pay a lot more for a half mile or a mile to the gallon than you were 5 years ago. So a more complex engine system is in competition with a mild to medium hybrid system, which obviously has its cost implications. It's in competition with a diesel engine system, potentially upgraded transmission system. Each and every one of those has a cost benefit, and yes, we have a pretty good idea what we think those cost benefits are.
Another question here: any issues related to cold weather or hot weather operation?
Not hot weather specifically. Cold weather obviously is always a challenge with high level ethanol blends. The 20 MPA capable fuel injection system certainly helps there. The higher pressure you can run at startup, the better atomization performance you get from the fuel. So direct injection with higher injection pressures is certainly directionally correct to get us there. But as with all ethanol applications, there'll still be some challenge in extreme cold regions. But not nearly the challenge that current PFI engines have. Cold starting with ethanol, they're pretty much hopeless actually today, and a winter start on ethanol is pretty difficult.
Now, are you using corn, soy, canola? What kind of ethanol?
Well, the end ethanol to us really doesn't matter. Ethanol, there's only one formulation of ethanol, so whether it comes from cellulosic feedstock or glucose or, you know, sugar-based feedstock, it doesn't really matter to us.
Okay. Well, I know from the work we've been doing with climate change that soy freezes before canola.
Yeah,
it's biodiesel.
Well, or biodiesel, but in any of the ethanols, you have different plants freezing at different temperatures. I wondered if you use some of the hardier northern climb plants, if you'd get different reactions in your fuel.
We haven't, that's not really our area. We haven't, looked into that at all, but I believe once the refining process is done on the ethanol, the properties of the fuel are fairly well set. That's what we've seen so far.
And what are you hoping to learn in June? You said you're doing further testing in June.
That's basically just the development of the next generation boosting system and the optimized engine component, and then just calibration mapping, and transient mapping to get this thing into a vehicle this year. So I guess the short answer is we're trying to take the theory and put it into practice over the next 6 months or so.
Well, this is Bob Firewood again. We're getting close to an hour now. Any last-minute questions?
Question, have you ever considered using methanol as a replacement for ethanol in the same system?
Not on this project, no.
Okay, so you all know about the compatibility problems that might arise.
Correct.
Yep.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Just wondering if maybe you should report some of the results on a CO2 basis instead of miles per gallon.
Yeah, I certainly can do that. Obviously that's a pretty easy conversion. I probably should have put that in the presentation. I apologize for that. But basically, obviously, when you start looking at CO2, it makes ethanol look very, very good. As you might expect, it makes about 66% of the CO2 per gallon that gasoline does, and gasoline has about a 10% per gallon advantage over diesel based on the density difference. So both this engine running on both gasoline and ethanol looks very, very good on a CO2 basis. And maybe I can provide that data to Bob or something, and he can send it out.
That would be excellent.
Yeah. CO2, of course, is a proxy for is in its own way a sort of a proxy for the heating value as well.
Yeah, it's all related, right? It's just completely based on the chemistry of the fuel, and assuming a certain completeness of combustion, it's pretty easy to translate MPG to CO2 for these fuels.
You were
going to
say something.
No, I'm through.
Okay, I'd like to again thank Luke and Rod and Ricardo for a great presentation. And I'd also like to announce that our next teleseminar is going to be in 2 weeks, the 25th. Brian Duddy of the Rochester Institute of Technology is going to talk. Do you want to say something, Peter, about what his presentation will be?
He just came out with a study recently, and I believe this will be the focus of most of his presentation, on E20. And in the summary, it appears that they found very little degradation using E20 over E15. And what kind of caught my interest was there's a reduction of carbon monoxide by 23%, which is as greenhouse gas emissions in terms of CO can extend the lifespan of methane. So should be interesting.
And for those of you who don't know, this research was funded by DOT.
Thanks.
So we're trying to share some of the engine research that we've been doing at DOT with some of the stuff with USDA, so everybody's better aware of the results we're getting out of our research.
Thank you, MJ. And Peter. And thank you all again. We'll be talking with you again in a couple of weeks.
All right, thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.